Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we learn about one of the most fascinating and contradictory American presidents, Woodrow Wilson. Wilson was a Southern Democrat, but a progressive. A segregationist, yet he elevated Louis Brandeis, the first Jew, to the Supreme Court and supported women's suffrage. A man who championed the human rights of self-determination around the world, yet suppressed civil liberties and free speech here at home. Man who transformed higher education as president of Princeton and tried to transform world governance through the League of Nations. He gave us the income tax and the eight-hour workday. He began the traditions of addressing Congress directly and was part of the biggest presidential cover-ups of all time, hiding the effects of a devastating stroke that left him an invalid for the last 18 months of his presidency. This all becomes fodder for my guest today, biographer A. Scott Berg, a National Book Award and Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of Samuel Goldwyn, Charles Lindbergh, and Katharine Hepburn. This latest book was 13 years in the making. Wilson is published by Putnam. Berg will be a guest of Booksmart Tulsa Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Schusterman Jewish Community Center. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Scott Berg, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
So nice to be with you again, Ray.
You write of a very different Woodrow Wilson than most historians have, who have often portrayed him as, of course, very, very smart, but aloof, imperious at times, a guy who was sort of the smartest man in the room and who was, in no uncertain terms, let you know that, which, is, of course, doesn't make the best attribute in a politician. But yet you write of a man of lots of passion and certainly a very adept politician, a very different picture of him. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, because I think Woodrow Wilson was all of those things. And after spending 13 years researching and writing my book, and indeed reading about Woodrow Wilson for more than 40 years, just because he's been a lifelong interest of mine, I really came to feel that the image of Wilson that has long been out there is not who he actually was. And going through thousands, tens of thousands of his personal letters, including two troves of papers that have just been recently discovered and were given to me to go through, mostly from family members and from his personal physician, I could see that the real Woodrow Wilson was this extremely emotional, as you suggested, very passionate man in everything he did, whether it was courting his two wives, the first one having died in the White House, or in presenting the League of Nations to the world. This is something that really controlled who he was. He was a man of just great intensity in everything he undertook. And as a politician, even though he was perceived as extremely aloof, he proved to have very sharp political elbows and great political acumen. He was a fantastic speaker, and he could convince everybody.
Where does this idea of aloofness come from? Could he be that way at times when he...
Well, he certainly could be that way, and I think it comes from the fact that Woodrow Wilson spent most of his life, in fact, in academia. He was a college professor, and in fact, Wilson really enjoyed the most meteoric rise in political history. I mean, here was a man who had never run for office until his mid-50s. He was a school teacher, basically. He was at Princeton most of his career as a professor and then as the president of the university. So he was a very serious academician. And then suddenly he was catapulted into the presidency after less than 2 years as governor of New Jersey. And so I think most people thought when he walked in, and to this day, all they can figure in their minds is of this rather severe-looking character who was a school teacher.
Now, did he have that tendency to be the smartest man in the room from what you could see?
Yes, he could certainly use that, and he used it as both a tool and occasionally a weapon, especially when he was introducing new measures, as he did as governor of New Jersey, when he became the most progressive governor in the country overnight, and even in his early days, passing a very progressive domestic agenda as president of the United States, he would almost sit down the lawmakers and give them a little class in government. You know, Woodrow Wilson was one of the very first political scientists in this country. He's our only president with a PhD. So, in truth, he was the smartest man in the room, and there's no way around it. And he did something interesting, too, which was he never dumbed anything down. He never made his vocabulary any less. He never shorthanded his thoughts. And as a result of that, the least educated people, especially, really appreciated Woodrow Wilson because they felt that he was not patronizing toward them. And in fact, they understood him and they understood his passion. And as a result of that, they were uplifted. And that was, I think, one of Woodrow Wilson's great charms. He was never a snob. He didn't have that about him at all.
Now, he is a very fascinating character in our history. He's the first Southerner to win the White House since the Civil War, and really the only one till LBJ. He was the first true-term Democratic president since Andrew Jackson, and it would be Franklin Delano Roosevelt before that happened again. But he's also a bundle of contradictions. As you just said, he was a very bold progressive, yet as a Southerner, he was a segregationist. Yet at the same time, he appointed the first Jew, Louis Brandeis, to the Supreme Court. He would champion human rights and self-determination in the post-war world, yet he suppressed civil liberties probably, well, as much as any president until after 9/11.
That's accurate. No, that's accurate. He was indeed a bundle of contradictions, and I think Wilson would be the first to tell you that most people are bundles of contradictions. And the one thing he really didn't like in politics was labels, because he felt if you were a real thinking and growing politician, you should be changing all the time, because life is changing all the time. I mean, just look at how the world changed in Woodrow Wilson's time. I mean, there he was, a 19th century figure born before the Civil War, grew up in four states of the Confederacy, actually saw Robert E. Lee ride through his town of Augusta, Georgia. I mean, looked into his eyes. So he had that sense of history. But then here is a man who really ushered the United States into the 20th century, came up with a foreign policy that we still use in the 21st century, and all because things change all the time. And Wilson used to say, even to the staunchest conservatives, that even if you want things just to remain as they are, he said it's a little like a white picket fence. Even if you want it always to remain white, you have to keep renewing it. You have to keep painting it white, because just on its own, it is going to deteriorate. So all this, I think, had to do with the fact that Wilson himself defied labels. And I think he felt that should be true of any really active and intelligent politician.
So what were the main forces that shaped him? Obviously, Princeton was a great factor. That's where he went to school, where he became a professor, and it was his first introduction to politics when he became the president of Princeton, which, as any academician will tell you, that the politics and academia are just about as fierce as anywhere else. How did Princeton shape him?
Well, indeed. In fact, Wilson said the reason he ran for political office was to get out of politics, because the politics on a campus, especially a small campus in the middle of New Jersey, was incredibly intense. Wilson used to say that the reason campus politics at a university are so extreme is because the stakes are so low. And so everybody's always fighting for every little crumb. And I would say even just before Princeton, I think the most formative element of Woodrow Wilson really came in his childhood, his youth, that Southernness that you were talking about. He used to say time and again that there was one part of the country, indeed the world, he said, that doesn't have to be explained to me, and that's the South. And he carried a lot of the South with him for the rest of his life. Then, indeed, at Princeton, he was formed intellectually, and he became a great student, and as you suggested, a student of politics very early on. He became the only president with a PhD, which he did at Johns Hopkins, where he became, as I suggested, one of the first political scientists in the country. So he really studied all this. Then when he became a professor at Princeton, he proved himself extremely indispensable on that campus, so much so that in 1902, after he'd been there 12 years, they made him the president of the university. And there he introduced reforms in education that not only affected Princeton, but indeed higher education to this day. And most colleges and universities follow a model of what you study and how you learn it from Woodrow Wilson's model, things he established back in the early 1900s.
So that would be just like a general ed course of sort of arts, well, humanities, science, and literature?
And even a little more specific than that, if you went to a college in which you majored in something, and in which there was a sequence of courses within that major, and then you took some electives to complement that, and maybe you had two lectures a week and a small class, well, all those are Wilsonian notions that he combined into what college education should be like. He especially disliked college education before him, in which even at really good schools, students would show up, a professor would talk to the class, just lecture. The next day, you would be called upon to recite back what you had just heard the day before. Wilson wanted to change that, and he introduced something at Princeton called preceptorials, in which each class, no matter how big it was, would break down to a small group of 5 or 6 students, maybe 10 students, but you would sit down with a young professor, and the whole class would discuss among themselves what they had read and what they thought. Wilson was really encouraging free thought and free speech, if you will, which becomes quite ironic, as you pointed out, because later he became so suppressive during World War I about free speech.
And really, getting back to a theme of his presidency, he's also tackling the social structure of Princeton, which at that point was sort of an aristocratic institution where white, rich men sent their young sons to go to college. And all of a sudden, he's saying, no, you're just not going to hang out here and go here for 4 years. You're going to have to study rigorously. And he really tried to transform the social structure of Princeton as well.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. And in fact, his predecessor as the president of Princeton used to proudly claim that he ran the finest country club in all of America. And in many ways, he did. I mean, it was an enclave for the very rich on this beautiful green campus. It was quite splendid, as it still is, although the social structure has completely changed now. What Wilson did at Princeton, what he wanted to do about the social structure, was something he then brought to the White House, even. And it was this attitude of leveling the playing field. You know, Wilson had been a poor minister's son when he went off to Princeton. And suddenly he was surrounded by the sons of the very richest men in the country. And there was great social exclusion for kind of a poor kid like him, who viewed education as an opportunity to advance in life, to get ahead in America. And so all the things Wilson introduced at Princeton socially were attempts, again, to level this playing field. And when you see Wilson in the White House, that is the theme of almost every piece of legislation he enacted.
Let's talk about his entry into politics. In 1910, the Jersey political machine, one of the most corrupt in the country, if we're to believe Boardwalk Empire.
You don't have to be kind about it. I think we can say they were the most.
Okay. They're getting a lot.
And in Chicago.
Right, exactly. They're getting a lot of publicity about this. It seems to me they're looking for a front, a guy who looks to be squeaky clean that they'll be able to control. Is that why they came to Woodrow Wilson and asked him to run for governor?
You have it exactly. They were looking for somebody to clean up their reputation. And beyond that, they were looking for a puppet, quite frankly.
Yeah, they didn't want him to actually clean it up, but he actually did.
Oh, no, they want him to look like he might clean it up. They wanted him to look clean. They didn't want him to clean it up. That's the difference. And they figured, once we get this guy in, I mean, what does he know about politics? He's a college professor. We'll just sort of pull his strings. And they asked if he wanted to run for governor. He accepted that offer. He won the nomination. He ran in the election and won in a landslide. I mean, an absolute landslide. Little did they know, the very first thing he would do as governor of New Jersey was kick out the political machine. I mean, he literally barred them from entering certain buildings in the government. And now everybody in America, you see, was turning toward New Jersey and saying, who is this man? Where did he come from? Let's start paying attention to him. And nobody paid closer attention than the power structure in the Democratic Party nationally, who suddenly realized we may have a very formidable political candidate to run for president in 1912.
Do you think Wilson would have won in 1912 if Roosevelt and Taft hadn't ruptured the Republican Party?
Indeed. I think had just one of them run, I think Wilson would have beat either of them.
Really?
I think there's no question he would have beaten Taft, who had grown increasingly unpopular. But I think he could have beaten Teddy Roosevelt as well. I think the people had gotten a little tired of Roosevelt. You know, he was kind of this big bully personality. And Wilson was a new idea. He was a new look. The way he spoke was different. You know, politicians before Wilson, like Teddy Roosevelt, you've seen pictures of him where he's sort of pounding his fist up to heaven, you know, and declaiming for the third balcony. Wilson wasn't like that. He talked straight to the people. He talked in a normal voice. And the people really responded to this. And they rather liked how intelligent he was. They rather liked that he was not a Washington insider. And in fact, the very first political figure really to come to Wilson's side was one of Oklahoma's first senators, Thomas Pryor Gore, who really championed Wilson and thought he was the real deal.
Of course, there's some pretty acid quotes from Gore, too, about Wilson. It was like a...
Indeed.
It was a singeing relationship. He championed him, but it was like, you know, they didn't always see eye to eye.
No, you're absolutely right about that. You know, Senator Gore, of course, was the blind senator, and as such, he sort of saw everything. He was really one of these all-seeing people, and he was rather pure in his own progressive politics, and he rather turned on Wilson because he felt Wilson was making too many compromises here and there, and that Wilson, well, leading us into the war, Senator Gore had a lot of problems with that, leading us into World War I. But he said at one point, you know, Woodrow Wilson had no friends, only slaves and enemies.
Yeah, that was a great quote.
Yeah,
interesting quote. My guest today is A. Scott Berg, the Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award-winning biographer. His latest biography is of Woodrow Wilson. It's simply titled Wilson. It's published by Putnam. Fascinating look at this president. And once he takes office, again, this contradiction, he's immediately outlining a progressive agenda, instituting income tax to lower tariffs, again, to lower income inequality. He's doing a Federal Reserve, creating the Federal Reserve. And, of course, one of his first actions is to segregate the federal government as well.
That is correct. And I think this came about for several reasons. The first of which is, I think in his heart of hearts, and he was really not a hater of African Americans. But as he said, because he knew the South so well, he really felt the country wasn't ready to integrate in 1913. And more than once, he said, it's really going to take another generation or two before this country can accept that. You know, this was still a period where the Civil War was still alive in people's hearts in the South. A lot of people wanted to refight the Civil War and go back to where they were. But there were still veterans of that war, and there were children of those veterans who saw what happened and saw what life used to be. So I think that was part of it. To be really honest and a little cynical about it, though, I think Wilson had a political agenda here as well, which is that he had this very progressive agenda he wanted to get passed, and he knew in order to do that, he would need that very solid block of Southern Democrats. He needed them all to vote for everything he put before them, and they made it very clear from the very beginning that if Wilson had any intentions of integrating the United States, he would get nothing passed. And so at the end of the day, I really do think the bulk of the new freedom, all his very advanced measures, I think they were passed on the backs of the black man who really had to just sit by the sidelines for another 50 years.
And of course, the progressive program is everything from the Federal Farm Loan Act, which helped rural farmers, which
Huge.
Were in great poverty at that particular time, building federal roads across the country. 8-hour workday, the Adamson Act.
The 8-hour workday, workman's compensation. And as you said, you know, while Wilson did have a racial problem, he was not anti-Semitic in any way. And he did put the first Jew on the court with Louis Brandeis, which was wildly controversial. I mean, he had a very hard time getting that through. And in fact, there really hasn't been a Senate hearing on a justice until Clarence Thomas that even rivaled that surrounded Brandeis.
Mm. He was also embraced suffrage, women's suffrage, which, again, you just keep seeing these contradictions where it's like has no problem with segregation and keeping blacks as second-class citizens, yet he's bringing gender up to some measure of equality.
No question about it. And here's another example, though, because I should be honest about Wilson on this fact. He was slow in the beginning to come to it. And for his first few years in the presidency, he didn't do much about women's suffrage. He believed women should definitely have the vote, but he thought it should be a state-by-state thing and that there shouldn't be an amendment to the Constitution. And then gradually, as he was in office and as World War I broke out and as the United States was fighting, he began to question, how can we be fighting for democracy around the world when half our population can't even vote? And almost overnight, he had this change. I mean, he really did see the light. And then he became the greatest crusader for women's rights in this country. And so it then passed very quickly after that, with all his muscle behind it. And even though the women who had been opposing him for a couple of years for being so slow praised him in the end for all that he had done. But it shows you this element of Wilson, again, of the ability to change, of never being stuck in an idea, and therefore never being stuck in a past time. He was always about moving forward.
2 years into his term, his wife dies. Ellen Wilson dies of Bright disease. And Wilson goes into a serious depression. He actually considers resigning. How seriously do you think he considered resigning?
I think he considered it very seriously. And you're right about the depression. I mean, he could barely get out of bed. He was distraught. And I went through diaries and letters of people who were in the White House who all could not help commenting on this man. I mean, he just sort of moped through the halls. And then finally, it got turned around by two things, I think. The first was a great sense of duty, because World War I literally broke out that week. And so he realized he couldn't just stay in bed. And then over the next year, something kind of wonderful happened. And it's something I really, again, tried to show in this biography of Wilson, which is the personal side. The president, in his mid-50s, falls in love a second time. He met an attractive young widow in Washington, and he spent the next year courting her, having private dinners at the White House, always chaperoned, I should add, but writing hundreds of extremely passionate letters to her, sometimes three times a day, even though he was going to see her at dinner that night. And indeed, within a year, they were married. And the president just completely changed. I mean, he was utterly revived. And the two of them, the second Mrs. Wilson, Edith Galt Wilson, and Woodrow Wilson, were hardly apart a day until Wilson died. I can really count, as I do in the book, the number of days they were not together.
Let's jump ahead to the end of World War I. Wilson goes to Paris for the conference to create the League of Nations, to hopefully... You know, his 14 points during the war basically said that these empires that have governed Europe are going to be broken up and that they'll have independent countries. That certainly happens, but not in the way he wants. And, of course, the League of Nations, while it's created, is an ineffectual organization, mainly because the United States votes against it. And many people think that that was what, a lot of people will say that destroyed Wilson, the fact that he couldn't deliver his own country to the League of Nations and led to the stroke that left him an invalid. Do you put any countenance to that?
I think every word you said was right on the mark. It devastated Wilson when he came back from Paris, where he had been negotiating the treaty. And I should add, because this is just incredible, the president of the United States left the country for more than 6 months. He was living in Paris, sorting out the world with the leaders of 25 nations. When he got there, he realized that 24 of those countries all had very personal agendas for their nations, and that was to get back territory or money. You know, France wanted Alsace-Lorraine back. The Allied countries wanted restitution, you know, for their financial losses during the war. Wilson went over and wanted none of that. All he really wanted was to create this League of Nations so that perhaps we had just fought the war to end all wars. He really did believe that. He believed that, in fact, had there been a League of Nations in place in 1914, the war would not have broken out. It would have been settled at the peace table before it had been able to explode into a big war. So Wilson comes home knowing that he can draw up the treaty, but it needs the Senate to ratify it. And the Senate was growing increasingly hostile and Republican, and they wanted nothing to do with anything Wilson brought back. And when Wilson realized they were not going to pass it, he decided to take his cause to the people. And he went around the country on a 29-city tour. And indeed, in the middle of that tour, he collapsed, was rushed home, and a few days later, he suffered a stroke. And then the story really gets interesting and unique.
That's
because,
right,
as I suggest in the book, the greatest conspiracy in White House history, I think, then took over when the second Mrs. Wilson and a handful of doctors simply decided not to tell the world that the President of the United States had suffered a stroke.
In fact, the doctor you mentioned that you had access to his personal papers,
yes,
is one of those doctors, Dr. Kerry Grayson, his personal,
exactly,
physician.
Right.
And they managed to carry this off. 18 months, the president not being seen in public, and yet nothing happened.
Well, yes, that's sort of it. It's so hard to imagine today, but you know, you have to remember, Mrs. Wilson did not Instagram, she did not tweet. And so, you know, people began to wonder after a few weeks, well, how healthy, I mean, they knew the president collapsed, but they wondered, you know, what is the status of his health? And then after a few months, indeed, he was able to at least see some people. There'd be the occasional glimpse of him being actually in a car riding around the city. And a few people could report on his health. But indeed, for that last year and a half, nobody could see the President of the United States or get him to sign anything or act on anything unless it had passed through Mrs. Wilson's hands first. And in essence, as many people have argued, Mrs. Wilson became the first female President of the United States. The day-to-day activity in the White House was really being run by her.
Is there any sense that presidential decisions were actually made by her?
She would be the first to tell you that she made none, and I could find none that she actually made that was contrary, certainly, to anything he did. But she basically decided, you know, since there are hundreds of things that come into the president's office every day, she basically decided what the president would even see. What issues, I mean, out of the hundreds, maybe two or three would reach his hand on a given day. And before that, she would have gathered all the information and the opinions on it by talking to the various people, and she would present the case to him, and then he would make his decisions. So she would say she was nothing more than a steward. Some might say she was really just a good chief of staff, but the fact of the matter is she was deciding what was going to be decided. Mm. And that in itself really decides how the executive branch is functioning day to day.
Well, we're out of time now. A fascinating look at Woodrow Wilson. The name of the book is Wilson. Scott Berg, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award winning biographer A. Scott Berg speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Wilson. It's published by Putnam. He'll be a guest of Booksmart Tulsa Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Schusterman Jewish Community Center. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.